All right, I will call this meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 28th, 2023. We do have a quorum. Before we get to the minutes, this is a reminder for everybody on the committee. In our rules for this committee, number 4 is that appropriate and respectful decorum is required, and that during the hearing, all presentations, discussions, and questions must go through and be recognized by the chair. We've struggled a little bit in the last week or so to follow that, and it is a privilege to do this work, and you lose the privilege to do the work of this committee if you cannot follow the rules. So if folks cannot be respectful to our testifiers, to our presenters, to each other, I will not be calling on you moving forward. There are consequences for actions, and you earn a privilege, and that is how I'm going to be conducting this committee going forward. So that goes for everybody. So I wanted to say that on the record, because on and off throughout this year, we've struggled a little bit as members, and I think it's important that we do follow that appropriate and respectful decorum, and that we extend that to everybody who is in this room with us, whether they are members or the chair or presenters. So with that, we'll move on to the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 21st, 2023? Representative Moeller.
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Moeller moves approval of the minutes for February 21st, 2023. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are approved. All right. Representative Curran, we're back again. So members, this is the bill. We got the testimony in just under the wire last week. We had Mr. Watson from the city of Venice Heights here. Representative Curran, so we already took public testimony. There was nobody else here who wished to testify. We already had noticed it and had an opportunity for amendment, so we're just going to move it now that we actually have the fiscal note. We were hoping that we would have the fiscal note ahead of last week, and we didn't, but now we do. So Representative Curran, I will move. Well, Representative Curran, would you like to move House File 1414 back before the committee?
Yes, so moved.
All right. And then would you like to refer the committee to be the recommendation that we refer it to Ways and Means?
Yes, that is my motion.
All right. So now we'll move on. We have a couple minutes. I wanted to make sure we had time for member discussion since we were a little rushed at the end of our last hearing. So is there any discussion to House File 1414? Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Grant. I don't have a problem with this bill. I think the funds should go back into local jurisdiction instead of to the state with these issues. I'm just wondering why we don't have a set up so every county and every jurisdiction in the state is the same. It would make much easier for the state to do things. And so that's the only question I have. I did have an amendment, but I didn't get it in time to do that. So I'm just wondering why we don't treat every county the same, because even in greater Minnesota, our small counties and our small cities are struggling. They don't like to be the ones that they're called speed traps, but I think if there is fines and stuff, we should treat every jurisdiction in the state the same.
Any comment, Representative Curran?
Sure. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. I agree with you there. I do think that we need to make sure that there's equity throughout the state. In this case, this is addressing a particular issue from my community, and that's why I'm bringing it forward today. So if there are other counties that could benefit from similar pieces of legislation, I would support those as well. If there's a way that we could in the future work on equity statewide, I'd be on board with that as well.
Representative Johnson, sounds like maybe you have a new bill idea. Any follow-up, Representative Johnson?
No follow-up, just if we went to the same as what Hennepin County has, which is a lot, should actually do better for our Ramsey County.
All right. Any further discussion, House File 1414? All right. Any closing comments, Representative Curran?
No, we can keep it short and sweet. I appreciate the support.
All right. With that, members, Representative Curran renews the motion to refer House File 1414 to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. We don't Do we have Representative Zarowski? You know, all these... Okay. I was looking for Representative Kozlowski. Sometimes our other members struggle with our 8:30 a.m. meetings, but I see Representative Kozlowski is here and ready to go. Welcome to the committee. I will move to re-refer House File 774 to the Capital Investment Committee. Representative Kozlowski, please tell us about your bill.
All right. Well, good morning, Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee. I am here to talk about House File 774. Thank you for the opportunity for the hearing on this bill. It's really important for our Duluth community, but also for our state, in that it will provide funds to First Witness for the purchase and renovation of a larger building for a child advocacy center and a nationally recognized training center. I am personally wholeheartedly bringing this bill forward because since its inception nearly 30 years ago, First Witness has both grown in number of children served and services provided in response to cases of alleged child abuse. I've seen firsthand and experienced the need for these services, and First Witness Advocacy Center is really leading the way as a child-focused nonprofit agency offering hope and healing and justice for alleged victims of child abuse and for their families. As you may know, childhood trauma can last a lifetime and has been linked to adverse childhood experiences, or known as ACEs, in children. This leads to serious outcomes such as post-traumatic stress disorder, poverty, and other health problems that go unaddressed, and also has a lifelong effect on families, but also for our broader communities. So First Witness, who's here with me today, has a really bold vision that I believe that we can all get behind, right? We want a vision of a community, of a society that prevents and protects the littlest among us. And one of the things that they do really well is they partner with our schools, with tribal nations, and they offer robust and a comprehensive child abuse prevention program, serving the entire state with their nationally recognized training in child-focused forensic interviewing and family advocacy. Just this last year alone, they trained over 546 new advocates. So 10 years ago, First Witness served 70 children annually, and last year they served 220 children, providing child-friendly, legally defensible forensic interviews, intensive ongoing advocacy, mental health services, medical exams, and more. And they also facilitate a multidisciplinary team, which works with law enforcement, child protection, and attorneys to accomplish the best outcome for our victims, survivors of child abuse. So I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, and the first would be Tracy Klena, Executive Director of First Witness.
All right, Tracy Klena, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Great, thank you. Hello, Chair Beckerfin and members of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. My name is Tracy Klena, and I am the Executive Director of First Witness Child Advocacy Center. I'm really honored to be here today to talk to you. According to the CDC, 1 in 7 girls, 1 in 13 boys, and 1 in 4 non-binary youth in the U.S. will experience child sexual abuse before the age of 18. Every child has the fundamental right to be safe, to be treated with dignity, to be cared for, and to thrive in their community. Child abuse robs a child of this fundamental right. We as communities need to provide safety and justice to all children. First Witness is dedicated to the children and families in our communities. We offer a comprehensive and holistic child advocacy center to help those in need of our services. The moment a child walks in our door, we surround them with support so they are not alone during possibly the worst moments of their life. Through child-friendly interviews, advocacy, victims can heal from their trauma and find their way in the world again. As you can see in our summary, our impact continues to climb both in numbers and in services. First Witness sees our role in disrupting the cycle of violence and building safety both on the individual and the community level. Our team of professionally trained forensic interviewers protect child victims with safe evidence-based techniques. Our family advocates build connections across systems to represent families' needs. Our prevention educators spend time in classrooms empowering children around safety, strategies, and freedom from self-blame. They train teachers, they train youth-serving professionals and parents, both on prevention and appropriate response. 30 years ago, our center was built to serve as a place for child-friendly forensic interviews performed by a multidisciplinary team of law enforcement, social services, and prosecuting attorneys. Since our beginnings, First Witness has expanded both our efforts in numbers served and services offered. This increase has led us to desperately need a new building. This new building would include child and teen-centered spaces, spaces for ongoing advocacy services, an additional forensic interview for those emergency cases, a multidisciplinary team space that allows for law enforcement and social services to truly respond to the needs of these difficult cases. And finally, a training center that would serve the entire state that will bring investigators and advocates from around the state and country to learn from our national model. The course of child abuse investigation is challenging to navigate. To address this, we offer a comprehensive and holistic child advocacy center that provides prevention, intervention, and systems change. Thank you for your consideration of this bill, and I'm happy to answer questions after our second testifier, Attorney John Holitz.
All right. John, if you want to come forward and introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker Fleming. Thank you to the rest of you for listening to me this morning. My name is John Holitz. I'm an assistant St. Louis County attorney. I've been a prosecutor, and I've had the opportunity to focus maybe over the last 8 or so years on child abuse, child sexual abuse prosecution. And I can give you a lot of reasons why First Witness makes our job possible, but allows us to hold people accountable. I can give you a lot of reasons to support this, but I want to give you my two favorite reasons, because I know we're tight on time today. Number one, we need a space, we need a bigger space, and we need that space to be a special space. It's got to be authority reducing. Can you imagine if you were, instead of me sitting here, a kid sitting here testifying? Now imagine in a courtroom that's built on authority for law, authority for judges. That's an intimidating space for a kid to walk into. It's particularly intimidating when a kid walks in and the person on trial might be a loved one, somebody they trusted, somebody they cared about, somebody who took care of them. More than testifying, they probably want to run over and give that person a hug, despite the terrible things that maybe they've done to them. So that's, we're in a system built on authority. We're in a system anchored on authority, and that works really well for adults. It does not work well for kids. Kids have difficulty testifying. We, First Witness, Child Advocacy Centers, are built on a model of authority reduction, because we know that when authority is reduced in an interview process, it creates more truthful, more accurate interview. And so we need to have a space that reduces authority. Unlike a space like this or a courtroom that creates authority, we want one that where we meet kids on the level that they're at. We want to have an interviewer who comes in and can talk to them and reduces the stress and allows them to answer questions. So the place that we have right now does that, but it's too small. And so we've purchased new buildings that are going to do just that, and they're particularly special, and they will work like that. They'll look like, on one side, they look like, because they used to be apartments. So it looks friendly, it's child friendly. The kids walk in, they know that they're coming to a safe place that reduces authority. But that's why these buildings are so special. They also give us separate accesses so that people who, law enforcement officers, people with guns and badges, lawyers like me, when they're walking in to do these interviews, we're not walking by these kids. We're not creating authority. We're reducing authority. The other is training. And I know that that's been mentioned briefly. But one thing that we do that we are proud of, one of the many things we're proud of, but one of the things we're particularly proud of is the training that we provide, not just to Duluth, not just to Lake, St. Louis, Carleton, Cook counties, but all around Minnesota and beyond. We're proud of the ability to have something that we think is really special that we're really proud of, and then to be able to share it to other communities who don't have that, to train their staff to go back to conduct these types of interviews. That's something that I'm really also really proud of, and it's something we need more space to do, because right now we're begging and borrowing and stealing space to be able to do that, and that's not good. So I'd ask you to support this. We need the funding to be able to do this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony, and thank you to both of you for the work that you do. I know those child abuse and child sexual abuse cases, as the prosecutor and the person who has to go through all that evidence, some of the hardest work that attorneys can do. So thank you for your service. Any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, and thank you, Representative Kozlowski, for the bill. And, you know, your second testifier mentioned a little bit about this, but I was just going to ask if you could tell us a little bit about how this money in these buildings would benefit not just the people behind the work, but the community that's being served. And maybe you have some additional thoughts on that.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair, and to Representative Finke for that question. And as my testifier illustrated, behind the scenes for the multidisciplinary team, but also for families, the building that is currently in is, I believe, about 2,000 square feet, and quite literally the team and community and the folks who are being served are busting out of the seams of that space. And so I'll ask Tracy to talk a little bit more about, you know, the broad impact, but the ability to also not only be able to bring the team in, the service, the medical providers, the law enforcement, the legal teams, and give them the space to be able to do what they need to do together, instead of having to shop that out to the community and to find spaces, but also the ability to be able to serve multiple families and multiple children at the same time.
Executive Director Klana.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Becker Finn. And thank you for the question, because that's exactly what we're looking to do. The original vision of the building was really about that single child that was telling their story to the multidisciplinary team. Over the last 30 years, we have really broached into the community, worked closely with those families that are affected by child abuse, but more importantly, worked more closely with our partners in the community, from schools to youth serving agencies to hospitals to law enforcement, all of them having a space to not only navigate the investigation of these cases, but also to respond in a trauma-informed way, and that's exactly what this space will do. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, remember, just got one question and a brief comment about this. First of all, question to testifier Kalana. What is the local match that's going into this program for this grant? Generally, we require a local match as well. I'm just one thing I'm also wondering why it's in this committee. Normally, these are through OJP, which goes through public safety and not the Judiciary Committee, but I'm glad it's here, because some of these members need to understand why we got to this program. But first of all, what is the amount of local match?
And actually, before you answer that, I'll just let you know, as the chair of the committee, I was very interested in what they're doing in this program, and I wanted to lift up how important this is. You know, we do have jurisdiction over court stuff and child protection, and I just thought this was a really important program and wanted to lift it up. So as the chair, I asked to have it come to my committee, because I thought it was really important. They've been doing this work for decades and are successful. So that's why it's here, and not straight to capital investment. And then I'll go to Executive Director Klana to the local match question.
Great. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee. Our local match will be $2 million. Our total project is $3.5 million. We are in the middle of a capital campaign raising those local funds. We have raised about $1.1 million of that $2 million local match, and we are well on our way to reaching that goal.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Executive Director Kalana, Thank you. Yeah. I think it's important for the local communities to be involved in these. Mm-hmm. I actually have a child advocacy center in my district. I was asked to be on the board of directors on that one, but because I'm a legislature, I said no, because I'm working on funding and stuff like that. But I want to get a little bit of the history why we, for the members that probably don't know how we got here to have these child advocacy centers. 38 years ago, situation arose in Scott County, and it was a fiasco. Made a mess of the entire system and put a lot of these cases at risk where they could not be, the perpetrators could not be tried. But it also, in the Scott County, it indicted and charged a large number of people. I think it was around 50 that should never have been charged because of false accusations. And from that experience, we got into these child advocacy centers, which is a one-stop shop for all the needs. It's for a child, it's just one interview. Everybody's there. All the services are there. The prosecutors are there. The law enforcement investigators are there. Mental health professionals are there. And a very specifically trained interviewer is interviewing these children. It's a great program. I support it 100%. But generally, the grants have been into not specifically named. They've been to a normal fund, and it's a competitive grant for these because we still need about five of these across the state to get things covered the way we need. And this is taking funds that could help areas that where people have to drive 200 miles to get to one, and taking those funds that, but it's a good program, so it's an area that we need to work on, get more funding, get more advocacy centers set up, because they're so important, not only to make sure that we get the proper interview of these children, but also to protect those that are actually innocent, because the interviews are so detailed, it protects the innocents, but makes sure they get the proper evidence to charge the perpetrators that are actually doing this. So thank you for bringing this. It's a great program, but I'm just concerned that we're bypassing other areas of the state that need these as well.
I don't know if you've ever made the drive from Grand Portage to Duluth, but that's not a short trip either. So any comment, Representative Kozlowski? Otherwise, we've got a couple people on the list.
Right, and I appreciate you sharing the history and the background and illustrating that for us. You know, I think the importance of having these centers that not only serve our community but broadly statewide, as illuminated in the counties. I was going to ask our testifier if you go out to the children and families too, which I thought there was a component of that, but I think having the investment of both the state and our local communities is really important as well. Thank you.
All right. Executive Director Klana, and then we got to move on because I've got a lot of bills on the list today. But Executive Director Klana.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, and thank you for your comments and questions. I will say that is one of the reasons that we do need a larger building, because we have expanded our services. Originally, they were just in St. Louis County. Currently, our core services are in Carlton County, Lake County, Cook County, which, yes, is a long drive. However, those local law enforcement agencies and social service agencies are supporting the family in getting to our center.
Thank you. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I read this, this is for the building, and there is another bill that we are hearing in public safety for victim funding in general that the different advocacy groups are bringing together, but that's separate from the building that's in here. So I just wanted to make that very clear. Both things are important. I don't think it's an either or situation. So I mean, I'll just say that as a prosecutor, I have watched way too many of these videos over my years, and I can still very vividly remember some of these, the things. So what the work you do is so incredibly important. also so people, there's a lot of criticism about prosecutors not prosecuting cases, and I think people need to understand that if a child victim is unable to testify, that case actually cannot go forward because of the confrontation clause. And so the work that this group and other advocacy centers do really ensures that the child's able to tell their story in that trauma-informed way, and that if there's an ability to prosecute the case, you will. But if the kid just shuts down and can't do it, you really, really are unable to prosecute those cases and hold offenders accountable. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Kozlowski, for this bill. I think this is an amazing program. And just kind of a quick question for you. During the testimony, I had kind of heard, you know, the environment that this provides for children who are survivors of sexual abuse. This environment allows for a more truthful and open interview. So looking at this sort of from a public safety lens, question for you, Representative, is do you see programs like this helping to prevent future abuse and sort of based along the lines of Representative Mohler's comments?
Representative Kozlowski.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and Representative Curran. Absolutely, and I think that investing in a program like this not only seeks to end violence when it happens, but their first witness is really leading the way in being out with their schools, out with youth, with families, in community-based settings to really help children and families understand the signs, to be able to tell their stories and understand who they can talk to, and so much more. And I'd invite you if you want to chime in about more pieces, but that is a really big component as being able to prevent. And this would actually, investing in this center and in this space and this team would allow them to expand that prevention work as well.
Executive Director, any response?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. I also want to add, thank you for that question. We know that child abuse can be multi-generational, and if we are giving children and their caregivers the opportunity to heal from that child abuse through therapy, through advocacy, through community supports, that violence in that family may stop there and not continue to have that multi-generational impact.
All right, thank you. Representative Kozlowski, any closing comments?
Yeah, I just want to close by saying thank you again for this opportunity. As we've heard, not only is this going to provide a better experience for children and families in Duluth, it's going to be able to also continue to help us prevent and intervene and disrupt those cycles of violence, all grounded in dignity and compassion. And so for years to come, this is a really important investment, and ask for your support.
All right, thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 774 be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much to our testifiers as well.
Thank you very much.
Representative Elkins. I can't see through all the tall chairs to know who's in the room. All right, Representative, moving right along, Representative Elkins, I will move to re-refer House File 1326 to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. Let's see, and Representative Elkins, you do have an A1 amendment. Do you want to do that first?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, I will then move the A1 amendment. Representative Elkins, if you could tell us quickly what the A1 does.
The bill as a whole is designed to close a loophole in the Data Practices Act related to the collection of selected transit data, and my testifier will explain that in more detail. But as written originally, it only applied to Metro Transit, and this is a provision that should apply to all transit agencies statewide.
All right. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Elkins, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Yep. So, Madam Chair, this is one part of about a seven-part Metropolitan Council housekeeping bill. and different pieces of it have to go to about four or five different committees. So we're going to have all of these pieces eventually end up in state and local government, where we'll put them back together into an omnibus housekeeping bill probably next year. And I have with me Dennis, who will be explaining the particulars of the bill.
All right. Please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, Dennis Dorshak from Metro Transit Revenue Operations. The purpose of this legislation is to increase the consistency in protecting the private data of our customers who are using our fare products. We request to include data that's not currently protected, such as by telephone, third-party software, transit assistance program members. We want to include all personally identifiable information, date and time the fare product was used, the mode of travel, the type of fare product. And we want to include other agencies that are not, other modes of transportation that are not included, such as Metro Mobility smart cards, Transit Link, Microtransit, the paper tap applications, or any kind of tap applications. And this is, right now, it's difficult to manage because of the different policies are fall under different categories. So we'd like to get some consistency within the legislation.
All right. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. This is just an additional information that is becoming private, which I believe it should, but also it's a growing program of where transit go cards are being used and special programs for discount of fares. And one of the things that with the discount go cards and all of that, location data is becoming more accumulated by Metro Transit. And so one of the concerns I have is that if location data and your smartphone that you have, there needs to be a tracking warrant or a search warrant based on probable cause. But here we have a government entity collecting more and more location data, particularly on a lower income, and they should have the same kind of protections as I think other folks have with search warrants. Now, I have spoken with the staff of the Met Council, and they said, well, it's other authorized by law, whatever is authorized by law. And that can mean just maybe data sharing. That can mean maybe by a court order. I think it's important to just say, hey, let's have one standard. Let's have a search warrant. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, sometimes when legislation like this goes through, it brings just more issues that sometimes, if it's not addressed now, it should be eventually, but this is an opportunity to share our point of view. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Any further members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Elkins. I had a discussion with him on the House floor yesterday. My concern is that there's no Tennyson warning given to the applicant so that they would know that on lines 3.1 of the bill, it says the council may disclose transit assistance program data to public or private agencies or organizations for the purpose of administering and coordinating human services, et cetera. And in addition to what Mr. Neumeister just spoke of, it's akin to having an app on your phone that tracks your whereabouts. So that is a concern too, but I do believe that maybe, and maybe the testifier could answer this question, is it possible to put a Tennyson warning on the application so that these folks that are entering into this program would know that their data could be shared for these purposes? And really, Madam Chair, I'd like to see the audit trails and all that, so when that information is shared, these applicants can go back and get the information of who their data has been shared with.
Senior Manager Dorshak.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, of course, the council does have a Tennyson warning that we do by practice use for our fair products, and this will be included in the TAP program, correct?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be glad to work with Representative Elkins and talk through the other aspects that I think the audit trails and so forth on this program. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And to clarify, so this information is already being collected and we're trying to reel this in to protect it. So anything we do in this bill is better than what's currently happening. Is that okay? I see nodding heads. Okay. Any further discussion to this bill? All right. Representative Elkins, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would say that I have been doing a lot of work on locational data privacy more generally. And I've already on my list of interim projects is to bring something to the Data Practices Commission this summer that would propose probably a more sweeping update of the whole Data Practices Act as it relates to locational data privacy.
Well, you better talk to Representative Scott before you get something jacketed. Or we don't want to spend all that time in committee.
it's an interim project.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1326, as amended, be referred to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Yep. Thank you, Representative Elkins. I did see Representative Hansen J. in the room earlier. All right. Representative Hansen, welcome to the committee. I will move your bill, House File 1521, be referred to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. Let's see. This is a, so just for reference, this is a Department of Human Services policy bill. And Representative Hansen, I understand you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment right away?
Yes, please, Chair.
All right. I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Hansen, please tell us about the A1.
Thank you. The A1 amendment just gets my bill into the shape that we would like it to be in.
All right. All those in favor of the A1, please say aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. This will be very quick, hopefully. HF 1521 is an agency bill that addresses technical and housekeeping changes needed for the statutes that are governing child welfare, child support, and the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Provisions related to child welfare aligns effective dates for the North Star Care for Children payment rate assessments with existing practice. It ensures that statutes governing relative searches include all relatives as defined in existing law, and it corrects an incorrect statutory cross-reference. Changes related to child support provide clarity on when a court can deviate from child support guidelines when a recipient's income increases. And finally, the bill repeals a statute related to the SNAP program that is not in compliance with the federal laws governing SNAP. Only the child welfare and child support provisions are within this committee's jurisdictions, and those can be found in sections 1-4 and part of section 5. So this, I have with me Jennifer Sommerfeld from DHS to just give you a quick overview of each section as well. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Director Sommerfeld, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm with Department of Human Services. And Representative Hansen really described the bill well, so my section-by-section review will be very brief. As Section 1 of the bill is related to the North Star provisions that you spoke about, making sure that the timelines for effective dates for the new rates or the original rate are aligned with current practice, so that it's not confusing for counties and families. Section 2 is related to relative searches. There was an error in drafting when we made some changes a year or so ago. And the way this reads right now, it looks as if we're excluding actual relatives of a child and instead only allowing relatives, adult relatives of a child's sibling. So we're making a technical change here to make sure that that can't be interpreted in the incorrect way. Section 3 simply deletes an obsolete cross-reference that doesn't exist any longer to make sure the statute is correct. Section 4 makes a technical housekeeping change to a child support statute. Right now it would appear that if a child support recipient's income went up, that you could not reduce child support for the person who's paying support, which is not what was intended when that language was passed I think, in 2021. And then Section 5 is a repealer of a child support section that no longer is needed. It's related to charging interest on child support, which was eliminated a couple of years ago. We no longer charge interest. So that's the bill.
All right. Let's see. It looks like we have one other testifier. Do you want to move on to the other testifier? Maybe we don't.
Chair, I think we had somebody else that was on deck in case Jennifer was bouncing between my other committee and this one.
Very smart. Okay, so we don't have the other person on the list. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing anyone. Any discussion? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill, and thank you for reaching out, Ms. Sommerfeld, on this issue. And just so members, because we haven't done a lot of family law on this committee, in Minnesota we work on this income shares model to establish the amount of child support. And most normally, I guess, and Ms. Sommerfeld can clarify this because she knows this like backwards and forwards in her sleep, but they base the child support on the combined incomes of the parents. And when one goes up, then the child support is usually adjusted. And so I'm happy in this situation that when the recipient's income goes up, which is always awesome, that it doesn't mean now that the combined income is more that the child support amount has to go up for the person that's doing the paying. So I just wanted to make that a little bit of a clarification for the committee members that that's how that works in Minnesota. And Ms. Sommerfeld could correct me if I didn't get it right, but thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, we're hitting all the things that we work on in a bipartisan way today with the data and the child support, fixing child support. Any comment to that, Director Sommerfeld?
My only comment is that one thing I will note is that it's very unlikely, if not impossible, that that will actually occur, that there would be an increase in the way the guidelines are put together. There only would be at some very low incomes. So,
got it. Any further discussion to the bill? Right. Not seeing any. Representative Hansen, any closing comments?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I appreciate the quick discussion on this and getting this moving so we can continue to do what's best for children and families in Minnesota and make sure every kid has a great start here in Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1521, as amended, be referred to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hansen. I did see Representative Tabke's head above the other chairs, so he's a little bit taller. Representative Tabke, welcome to the committee. I will move to re-refer House File 1347 to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. Members, this is another department policy bill, so very exciting morning here in our committee. Representative Tabke, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. I'm a little taller and a little shinier than most everybody else. So
I wasn't going to say that part.
I appreciate
part.
You pointing me out back there, so thank you. This is a MnDOT bill, and what basically is Marketable Title Act. And so what this does basically is if there is easement on lands that is not, if it doesn't look like it's being used, if it doesn't appear like it's being used, and somebody else wants to take control of that easement, this makes it easier and cleaner for MnDOT to be able to maintain control of that easement. And we have staff from MnDOT here to explain further.
All right. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Joe Pignato, and I am the Director of Land Management for MnDOT. Today I'm here to talk about the Marketable Title Act. Today, with the Marketable Title Act, easement owners are subject to a 40-year abandonment presumption. MnDOT and other state agencies and departments are not specifically identified in the Marketable Title Act to assert what's called a possession exception. Since this issue of whether MnDOT can assert the possession exception has previously been raised by some property owners, it is very likely that in the future further claims will come up. So MnDOT, we feel that if for this reason MnDOT believes the modification should be added to the Marketable Title Act to ensure the integrity of the trunk highway system. This proposed modification adds MnDOT and other state agencies to the list of entities that can raise the possession exception in the Markable Title Act. So pretty straightforward. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
All right. Anyone else wishing to testify on this bill? I'm shocked. members, any discussion to House Bill 1347? Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I was hoping that the testifier from MnDOT could help explain a little bit more about what it means that MnDOT has, what does it mean for MnDOT to have possession of an easement in order to be able to assert this? You know, we're talking about something that's potentially more than 40 years old, and so what does that look like in the real world for someone trying to clear title on a piece of property and that MnDOT might have an easement that they're asserting the possession exception on?
As fun as it would be to have Representative Tabke try to answer that question, Director Pignato.
Madam Chair, Representative, with our easements, a lot of the time folks will just see some grass sitting out there and we're not, quote unquote, within the possession of the easement at the time. But the reason that we have a lot of leave it as grass is that for snow removal, drift reductions, for drainage issues, for, you know, a lot of things that aren't driving on the road, putting pavement down, putting a turn lane in. So that's where in the actual Markable Title Act, under the possession exception, it calls out like a person, a corporation, another entity. It doesn't specifically say state agencies. And we've been challenged that we couldn't use the possession exception under subdivision 6. So this is just more of a clarification for us to say, you know, state agencies also can use the possession exception. It doesn't exempt us from showing possession. It just allows us to use that possession exception.
Representative Niska, any follow-up?
No, I don't have anything further. Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion to the bill? Representative Tabke, closing comments.
I have none, Chair. Thank you.
All right. I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 1347 to Transportation, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Do we have Representative? All right. Representative Carroll.
While we're waiting for the next one, I just thought I'd give you the opportunity to explain the statute against perpetuities.
All the lawyers laughed. The rule against perpetuities, everybody's favorite. Representative Herr, thanks for hustling down here. Sorry, guys, lawyer jokes. we could talk about the bundle of sticks next.
There you go.
All right, Representative Herr, thank you very much. We're clipping along with some very scintillating policy bills this morning, but now we're on to your bill. So I will move to recommend House File 1625 be re-referred to the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. I do see you have an A1 author's amendment, so I will also move the A1 amendment. Representative Herr, if you can just clarify what that A1 amendment does.
The A1 amendment was just fixing an oversight of when we had the bill redrafted from a 2020 date to a 2024 date. So it's
Changing the effective date to somewhere in the past is interesting. okay, so all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Herr, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Breckerfin, and I hope that when I walked in, you weren't laughing at me, you were laughing with me, or you're laughing at something else.
For the record, we were laughing at Representative Carroll's very funny lawyer joke about the rule against perpetuity, so it had nothing to do with this very good bill that's in front of us.
Thank you so
Representative
much.
Herr.
Thank you, Chair Breckerfin and members. This morning, I'm presenting House File 1625, the Preventing Pay Discrimination Act. I think this is the first time I'm in front of this committee to present a bill and not being part of the committee. I was on it for 4 years, but it looks like the committee is in good hands with all of these great members. This bill is actually not new to this committee. This bill actually passed out of Judiciary and out of Labor last biennium, and it was heard as a standalone bill in the House floor and passed with bipartisan support on a vote of 80 to 51. So this bill is very straightforward. It simply prevents an employer from asking what a job applicant's pay history is when they're negotiating their salary. However, this bill does allow a job applicant to voluntarily disclose their pay history, and if they do so, then the employer is allowed to use this information as necessary. Above all else, House File 1625 takes us one step closer to closing the pay gap in Minnesota. The pay gap in Minnesota is very real. I'm not sure the last time the statistics were presented in front of this committee, but women get paid 80 cents on the dollar for what a man makes. This drops even lower for women of color. Asian women make 71 cents on the dollar, and when you disaggregate that, Southeast Asian women actually make closer to 50 cents on the dollar. Black women make 59 cents on the dollar, and it's even lower for our Somali women. And indigenous women make 56 cents on the dollar, and Latinas make 53 cents on the dollar. So with House File 1625, we work to close the pay gap by saying that a job applicant can no longer be forced to disclose their pay history during their salary negotiation. Some of you may be wondering why and how this contributes to the pay gap, but this helps close the pay gap because the pay history question can give an employer a built-in excuse to pay a job application less because they are basing that decision off of someone's past history. The reason why they can do this is because the 1963 Federal Equal Pay Act actually facilitates the pay inequity. Employers sued under the Federal Equal Pay Act for paying women less will commonly defend their unequal pay practices by contending that they set salaries by relying on each job applicant's pay history. The United States Courts of Appeals from the Eighth Circuit, which covers Minnesota, has accepted this argument, holding that it does not violate the Equal Pay Act for an employer to pay women less if the employer determined pay scales by relying on pay history. By ending the pay history question, a job applicant's future wage will no longer be anchored down by their past, and we can break the cycle of discrimination that can follow women and BIPOC sometimes throughout their entire careers. It's also important to note that 18 states, including Alabama and North Carolina, have already passed their own pay history question bans. In 2020, a study by research at Boston University School of Law found that enactment of state pay history bans actually closed the pay gap 5 to 6% on average, and for female job changers, this increased their pay by 8%, and for African Americans, that was by 13%. In other words, adopting the pay history bans reduced both gender and racial wage gaps. It's time for Minnesota to step in to close the gap, to close our gap. So with me today, Chair Beckerfin, I do have Commissioner Lucero from the Department of Human Rights to testify in favor of the bill and to answer any questions that you all may have. So if she is here, I'd love to bring her up.
Commissioner Lucero. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
All right. Good morning, Chair Beckerfin. Members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. It's good to be back here with you this morning. First, I want to thank Representative Herr for carrying this agency policy bill and to the committee for giving the bill a hearing. So House File 1625, otherwise known as the Preventing Pay Discrimination Act, will help close Minnesota's gender and racial pay gap. As Representative Herr explained, it prevents pay discrimination from taking place when a Minnesotan applies for a job or negotiates their pay. It simply says, don't ask an applicant to disclose their pay history. Now, there are three reasons why it's important to be intentional about eliminating the pay history question. So first, women are consistently paid less than men with similar experience, qualifications, and seniority in the same position. And that pay gap increases for women of color and indigenous women. And Representative Herr provided some of those really concerning statistics around that. Now, there are many reasons why this exists, and one of the things we should do is start by looking at the structural systems that contribute to this outcome. So Professor Hasday, a law professor for the University of Minnesota, has joined us several times over the year, to testify about this bill. And she always starts her testimony by sharing that before 1963, it was perfectly legal for employers to pay women less. And it was, in fact, the norm to see help wanted ads that would list one salary for men and a lower salary for women for doing the exact same work. So the Preventing Pay Discrimination Act helps break this systemic discriminatory cycle that has not yet ended. Secondly, the gender wage gap persists even after the passing of the Equal Pay Act. And in fact, in Minnesota, We have not narrowed this over the past 5 years. So why is that? If an employer is supposed to pay men and women the same for the same work, why isn't that happening? It isn't 1963 anymore. And yet the same results of paying men and women differently persist, especially for women of color. So one important reason for this persistent wage gap is that employers frequently ask job applicants about their pay history before deciding what salary to offer. In fact, employers oftentimes ask it as part of the initial application, long before an interview has occurred, meaning that they're actually even taking that information into consideration about who should even receive an interview. So to be intentional about closing the gap, we look at what policies or practices, what formal policies and what informal policies are perpetuating this inequality in pay, resulting in this discriminatory outcome. The use of the pay history question is one of these practices that is neutral on its face, but in practice often causes inequality in pay. Again, if Professor Hasday was here, she would remind us, and echoing comments by Representative Herr, that in Minnesota, it does not violate the Equal Pay Act for an employer to pay women less if the employer determined pay scales by relying on pay history. This means that without this bill, an employer can pay a woman less than a man for doing the same work, so long as the employer can point to the woman's pay history as a basis for that discrimination, this discriminatory outcome. Again, this means that someone can be locked into this cycle of unequal pay that will impact them throughout the rest of their lives. The Preventing Pay Discrimination Act, again, aims to break this cycle. So the third reason is it works. In states that have eliminated the pay history question, they saw an 8% increase for pay for all women and a 13% increase for pay in black workers. This is good for Minnesota. I've had the pleasure of testifying about this bill multiple times, as you know, and when I do, I usually get a couple of key questions that I'd like to address. So the first question I get is, hey, how does this bill relate to current discrimination law? And I want to make sure that I'm providing that information, that this bill is fully aligned with the rest of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, as well as federal law, which often requires a burden-shifting analysis when deciding whether or not discrimination occurred. So right now, when someone contacts our office, they have to show that they have what's called a prima facie case. They have to meet the prima facie elements, alleging facts adequate to support their legal claim. At this point, the burden shifts to the employer to articulate a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for what occurred. And if an employer is able to show that legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for what occurred, the burden then shifts back. So there's this back and forth burden shifting. So for this bill, this means that if an employer uses a job applicant's past pay to set their wages, then it will be the employer's responsibility to explain why did they do that, which is in alignment with discrimination law today. The second question I get often is this difficult to comply with? Nope. This is a simple bill to comply with, which is demonstrated by the fact that many employers have already started making this change because they understand the importance of this. This is easy for small employers and big employers in the exact same way that employers cannot consider, for example, if someone is or is not pregnant. They also would not be able to consider previous pay. I myself have hired many employees myself throughout my career, and it's easy to comply. I simply do not use salary history when making an offer. So when someone applies for a job, I consider their qualifications, I consider their experience, I consider whether or not they have any relevant education experience, I certainly consider the market, but I don't ask if they're pregnant, I don't ask about their age, and I don't ask about their salary history. In closing, I want to highlight all the support that exists for the bill. That includes the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, Min-Min League Laid, and Girl Scouts of River Valley, all of whom speak about how important it is to close the pay gap. When Minnesota passes this bill, we will join a groundswell of over 20 states that have already ended the pay history question and will bring Minnesota one step closer to closing the pay gap. Thank you very much for the time, and I stand for any questions.
All right. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. I know that we're pressed for time, so Representative Herr, I'll just And Commissioner Lucero, I'll just put a quick plug in for expanding our data collection so that we're making sure we are collecting data on all members of our community, and point out that trans women make about 60 cents on the dollar to men, and this is an extremely important bill for our community. Hiring trans people is not an act of charity, and we deserve to be paid just like everyone else.
Thank you. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing this forward. I know this has been heard in the body before. It's my first time, but when I saw this, I was really excited. I know we have attorneys that giggle and geek out over some of the stuff in this committee, but I also am a human resources nerd. So I worked in human resources for several years. I interviewed hundreds of applicants, and what I noticed time and time again is that past pay has absolutely nothing to do with skill level, competency, anything like that. It's in my mind, asking for pay history is really just fishing for cheap labor and not looking at the best possible work and actually just honestly paying for the work that needs to be done. And I think that's where we need to head. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward from that perspective.
And I'll say, in my experience interviewing people too, I did want to point out subdivision C, that if the applicant were to disclose because they think maybe disclosing that they make more money at their current job as a negotiation, that there is a ability, if the applicant thinks that it's going to help them in their negotiation, they do have the ability to do that under this this language of this bill. Next on the list, I've got Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Herr, I'm just wondering how this is going to affect our state's largest employer. The state of Minnesota and our local governments and school districts and colleges combined is the largest employer in the state of Minnesota, well over 400,000 employees. And by statute, all their salaries are public. So their information is out there, but they can't. But on this bill, it can't be disclosed. How is that going to mesh with this program?
Well, I can actually, Representative Johnson, I'm going to point you to line 1.17, and then I'm going to go to Commissioner Lucero. Go ahead.
Great. Chair Becker-Finn, thank you very much, Representative Johnson, for the question. So in great news, the state already does not consider past pay as part of its analysis. So right now, when I work to hire people, there's a whole analysis that I do based on their level of education, what else is going on in the market, et cetera. And I fill out that form, and that's how I make my basis. It is really well defined that way. Now, of course, both if you are a current employee, if you're a current employer, private or public, or the information might be out there, that is outlined in here. And so there are many things that you might know. You might know, for instance, that somebody is pregnant. You cannot use that in determining their salary. You might know their age. You cannot use their age in saying, actually, I don't want to hire somebody of that age. And this is saying you cannot, you might know what their salary is. You can't use that in determining what their current or future salary will be.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, I just want to make sure that people understood that even though a salary is public information, when they're looking at hiring somebody, they can't use it. But that goes in, that can be two ways. I'm going to take a very good friend of mine was offered a different job. It was 40 miles one way less driving, but a 65% decrease in pay. It would have been a lot larger decrease in pay, but they knew that person's salary, so they bumped it up dramatically to get that person to come and work for them, which is now only a 2-mile drive from where they live. So sometimes it can work the other way. Knowing the salary that they're at can actually, when they're looking at changing jobs for different reasons, can actually increase their pay. So it works both ways. So it's just something to consider. I understand this, understand why we want to do this, but we got to also remember it can work both ways.
All right. We've got a couple members on the list, so I'm going to keep going. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr. My question really is focused on the rebuttable presumption language and starting in line 1.13. I'm curious as to whether the other states in which this is done also use a rebuttable presumption like this and whether that's necessary to reach the goals of the statute.
Commissioner or Representative Herr?
I would give my response of maybe around law schools, but I think Commissioner Lucero might be a better person to answer the question.
Commissioner.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Nesbitt, thank you for that. So there are over 20 states that have moved on this kind of ban, and there's different ways that states have enforced this policy. Some states took a civil penalty route. Some states take more of a discriminatory analysis route. Here we have taken a discriminatory analysis route, and that means that if an employer is found to be in violation, it will be their responsibility to explain why they use the pay history question to determine a job applicant's wage. So it varies across the country.
All right, follow-up, Representative Nesbitt.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lucero. Of the states that do use
this, I'm happy with my job.
Sorry. Commissioner Lucero, following up on that, you said that some states use the discriminatory statute or approach. What are there other states that define it as a rebuttable presumption using this kind of language? That was my question.
Commissioner.
Sure. Chair, Representative Nesbitt. So rebuttable presumption is a standard concept in anti-discrimination law, and I hope I provided some context to that in my testimony. It's very familiar, completely standard in employment and labor law, and it provides clarity on what the next step will be and if an employer is found to be in violation of the law. So if an employer used a job applicant's past pay to set their wages, it's their responsibility to explain why they did that. The rebuttable presumption language sets that clear standard for employers and job applicants and makes it easy for instance, small employers to know exactly what is being asked of them and what's being prevented of them from being asked.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I still am not sure that you answered the question about other states' salary pay history laws. And I agree with you that the burden shifting standard in federal case law, it's McDonnell-Douglas standard, is common. What isn't common from my understanding of both the Minnesota Human Rights Act and federal human rights laws, and I'm not sure other states' discrimination laws, is that we have a statute that calls out something, some particular thing, as being a rebuttable presumption of discrimination. And I'm really concerned that what we're doing is putting something different into that burden-shifting standard than what exists already in all of the other situations and creates a problem in which employers who aren't discriminating have a much harder time of establishing that they weren't doing something discriminatory. And the way this plays out in actual litigation is that that makes it much harder for someone who has a meritorious reason why they did something to get summary judgment. And that results in them essentially having to settle cases that might not be meritorious and might otherwise be shaken out at the summary judgment stage. And so I am really concerned that we're doing something anomalous and different in the statutory language that is going to create some really serious problems for good employers who aren't trying to discriminate. And that's the question that I'm getting at. And I would like some comfort that there is some other statute somewhere that uses this kind of rebuttable presumption language without creating those kind of negative consequences.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. So I appreciate the concern with putting something different in. So the Minnesota Human Rights Act also follows the burden-shifting McDonnell-Douglas test. It's not just at the federal level. So this is putting in place exactly what is right now the law that requires that when an employer does something, that they have a burden to articulate a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for why they did that. They have the burden to do that, whether that is discrimination based on age, discrimination based on race, sex, or hear whether regarding pay history question itself. So that is what is the law at the moment. Nothing different.
Follow-up, Representative Niska.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up comment, which is that we're using different language here than we use anywhere else. And so I'm very concerned that district judges and Court of Appeals judges and the Minnesota Supreme Court judges, when they read the language of the statute, are not going to just interpret this as being the same standard that they apply when we use different language, not defining something as a rebuttable presumption of discrimination. So I hope that we can find some way to write this in a way that's consistent with the rest of the Human Rights Act that also applies the burden shifting standard, and not create a situation where good employers are going to get caught up in a litigation trap.
All right. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lucero, thank you for being here again.
Still not.
not Senator?
I know. Haven't. Sorry.
It's totally okay.
Yeah, and I just had gotten a text from
Representative. We all miss him. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Lucero. I guess it's a contagion here. It is really. I'm just having a hard time, based on the back and forth that you two just had, Representative Niska and Commissioner Lucero. I'm having a hard time squaring away why we need the rebuttable presumption language when you're saying already that this is how it goes in your department and in these human rights cases. There's the burden shifting back and forth, and I'm just I can't understand. It seems duplicative to me. That you're putting this rebuttable presumption in on top of what you just said is the way you sort of operate anyway.
Commissioner.
Representative, Chair Becker Finn, Representative Scott, thank you very much for the question. Okay, and so first off, the Minnesota Human Rights Act is over 50 years old, and it is heavily based on both the act itself and substantial case law. So when we're putting in something like this, it's really getting at the systems that are in place. It's different than, it's a slight difference than how you think about discrimination law. This is getting at systemic issues. And so here we just want to be very clear about what the responsibility is. This is also about, I want to make sure that there isn't any uncertainty, especially for maybe employers that don't have an HR team, to be able to say, what is the burden here? And the burden is on you to be able to demonstrate a non-discriminatory reason for why you would have asked for that. That makes it very easy for courts, in fact, to align it with the other burden shifting process, because we don't have this in Minnesota right now, so it will be kind of a first impression to a certain extent when it comes up. So this makes it clear.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Lucero, does case law back up I guess, because some states use case law, right? And rather than put it in the human rights portion of their statutes, they go by case law to determine these cases. That's my understanding, anyway, of what other states have done.
Commissioner.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Scott, my understanding is that there are over 20 states that have specifically put something within their laws. And then the laws, the human rights laws or civil rights laws, rely on a lot of case law in interpreting and understanding them. So I think that helps clarify.
Representative
Thanks, Madam Chair. And so I guess I'll just end by saying we all want pay equity, right? It shouldn't matter, man, woman, whatever. Everybody wants pay equity, and I think that's what we're really trying to accomplish with this bill. And I just think putting that that presumption in there is the obstacle here for many folks, especially small employers who don't have their own HR department, who are trying to act in good faith. And I know Representative Niska asked you several times what other states are doing, and I do believe that we would be the only state that would have this rebuttable presumption. And so I think that's what gives us pause on this. I think it would be 100%, you know, it would be a unanimous vote if we didn't have that presumption there. And it's just, I'm still not understanding that it's really necessary for what's already the way that the Department of Human Rights operates on these sorts of cases. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I can say, you know, as the HR department for my small business, you know, it's, I think making it really clear, just don't ask. Don't ask and don't use this as you determine wages for folks. I actually appreciate, like, the very first sentence on line 1.10 is very clear that of what we're supposed to do. And I think that's, Representative Herr, obviously, I'll go to you to close out, but I think that's the idea, is that we're making it really clear in statute so that we're not relying on courts to then make decisions so that then we can apply things further down the line. We're being very clear in what we're trying to do in the statute. But Representative Herr, if you want to close us out.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, and members for hearing House File 1625. I really do appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill in front of the committee again, and I just wanted to address a couple of points really quick. Representative Johnson talked about public employers and that being actually public data. You know, the truth is that we do see that in the public sector there's less of a pay gap issue because those salary ranges are actually put out there and they base it on your education, your experience. And so when you look at the data of public employees, they actually have very little pay gap, if any at all, depending on whatever industry they're in. So the concern around public entities, I think, is for us, we don't actually have to worry about that, right? And the other issue around this rebuttable presumption is that if it is, I guess I'm confused as to, like, if it's, if this were out, there'd be 100% vote on this, but if this is in, what does it hurt? If we set standards, every state has different laws that are slightly different, and that if we don't take the opportunity at times to be more clear or to be more succinct at what we're trying to do in the message we're sending, then we really have missed the opportunity to say what if states are the same thing as we're doing with the marijuana laws, that where we saw our cannabis bill is that where we see where it's been, it hasn't worked, we change the language. They're not all the same across the state. And so when we have the opportunity to make a law better, we should. And this is the opportunity to do that. And so, yes, other states may not have this, and we will, and that'll make us a better state for doing so. So I just ask this committee support for this bill and so that we can move it forward and get this finally passed so that Minnesota can start being more equitable in its pay. Thank you, Chair Beckerfin and the committee.
All right. Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 1625 as amended to the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Herr. And members, we do have a little bit of time, so we're going to skip ahead in our agenda to my bill, House File 133. I will pass the gavel.
Madam Chair, as you're making your way, I'll put the bill in front of us. Would you like to move to recommend that House File 133 be placed on the general register? Madam Chair, your bill is before the committee.
All right. Thank you. So, again, members, yet another bill that we've discussed for a couple years here. House File 133 is simply adding in Chapter 13, so back on some data stuff, allowing for the release of information to tribal nations about their tribally enrolled or descended students. So, I think for most of you on this committee, it would not apply to your kids, but it would apply to my kids. And the idea being that folks may not know this, but a lot of tribal nations, we put our young people first, and a lot of funding and efforts go into making sure that our students are supported. However, for various reasons, our tribally descended students are all over the state. So even though my home community is in the Leech Lake area, my kids go to Roseville Public Schools, and this would allow the school to release some data to my tribe so that my tribe could better support my kids. You know, whether that's, you know, like backpack programs are really popular in the fall with providing school supplies and things like that to Native families. But it might also look like connecting other Leech Lake descended kids who go to Roseville schools but maybe go to different schools so that these kids can get some extra support from their tribal communities. It's often really challenging If you are a Native kid and you live in a community that's majority not Native, which let's face it, that's most Native kids in our state, having that extra help when you're kind of, my kids are routinely the only Native kid in a room. And so to have that extra support from our home community and our home nation could be really important. And so this was actually brought to me a couple years ago by the Department of Education, so it's an effort of theirs as well. So I do have a testifier from Department of Education to speak to the bill as well.
Mr. Tony, please take a seat, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Adele Shuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. And thank you for the opportunity to provide some supportive and explanatory testimony on this bill. And I want to thank Chair Becker Finn for persistently championing this effort over the past several years. So I'll just repeat a little bit. Just broadly, this bill would allow districts and charters to share private educational data with tribal nations about their tribally enrolled or descendant students, specifically to support the educational attainment and outcomes of those students. It adds tribal nations as a specific entity to a list of 17 already permissible uses and entities allowed to receive this private educational data, again, for legitimate educational purposes. Currently, we have 37 districts or charters that are required to engage in tribal consultation under the federal Every Student Succeeds Act. And many of our districts and charters are doing and have done a great job in partnering with our tribal nations or tribal representative entities like the Tribal Nations Education Committee to share data, to be able to look at what is the best educational programming for their tribally enrolled or descendant students, or to provide the assistance that these students and families may need in real time. However, there are some districts, based on legal advice, that are determining that since tribal nations are not explicitly listed in the list under Chapter 13 that Chair Becker Finn mentioned, and deciding and decide that they don't qualify as maybe a volunteer organization under Paragraph J, that the district is not allowed to share the educational data with the tribal nation for this, again, legitimate educational purpose without some type of prior consent. And we believe that, while we believe that tribal nations would qualify as a volunteer organization under this list, we do want to address maybe this concern or cautious legal approach, and so we've come forward with this proposal for several years that would facilitate explicit permission in statute for district and charters to have that legal cover that they could share the data with tribal nations, which would allow them not only to meaningfully engage in tribal consultation at a deeper level, but also to provide that real-time data to tribal nations to create that collaboration, that partnership, for the better outcomes of their students and families. Again, this would be for the purpose of enhancing educational programming and real-time support for students and their families, and looking at how that impacts students and how they're doing, and be able to provide advice to the districts or charter based on the data. As I mentioned a little bit, kind of the real-time support for children and family, this would allow tribal nations more opportunities to access the local data that MDEA may not receive on a regular or short-term basis, like attendance data, in order to provide quick support services to their tribally enrolled or descendant students. For example, a district could share attendance data with a tribal nation to allow them to support a student and a family with whatever they may need to return to regular attendance if the student wasn't attending for maybe a couple days. This is something that MDE would not be able to provide to the tribal nation in a timely fashion to get that assistance to that student and that family. So this proposal, again, would facilitate a deeper partnership between districts, charters, and tribal nations to support their students and families. And again, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to provide this support on this important initiative, and again, to Chair Becker Finn for consistently championing this effort.
Thank you, Ms. Sooney. Are there any members of the public that would like to testify before we move on to member discussion? Seeing none, any member discussion? Seeing none, Chair Becker Finn, any closing comments?
Yeah, thank you, members, for your attention to this. As folks who've been around have been on the Data Practices Commission, this isn't the first time that we've discussed this issue, and just appreciate members' support so we can better support our Native students in Minnesota.
Seeing no further discussion, Chair Becker Finn renews the motion to recommend that House File 133 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
All right, members, as folks know, we do have a couple more bills on the agenda. We will come back at 6 o'clock to address those bills. So we will not adjourn. We will go into recess, and you've got like 5 extra minutes to pick up a cup of coffee on your way over to floor. So with this, with that, we stand in recess. All right. Calling us back to order, it is still February 28th, 2023. We're going to pick up where we left off. Let's see. We do have a quorum. Yes. I know there's multiple meetings going on right now. Oh, in accordance with Rule 10.05, Representative Finke will be participating remotely by phone with the speaker's approval. Either way, a quorum is present. Today we've got digital fair repair. I will move House File 1337. Let's see. We're moving that this be placed on the general register. And I understand that you have an amendment. Representative Fisher, would you like us to move that amendment?
Yes, please. If we could move the A2 amendment, and then I can explain it now. Thank you. The A2 amendment just narrows things up in scope a little bit. Instead of the entire Chapter 8, would it be Section 8.31. And this was based on information and discussion that we had in the last committee stop. I want to thank Representative Niska. I know he had an amendment that was a little bit more encompassing that we're not quite comfortable with. But the points that he brought up on the Chapter 8 going to Section 8.31 instead was very good points. And so I'd like to recommend that we add that on.
All right, I will move the A2 amendment. Members, any discussion to the A2? Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Fisher just stating that I agree with this amendment as well. It's part of what I, an amendment that I'm proposing as well. And so, yeah, it's a helpful clarification. So I support it.
All right. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We're going to go through the presentation of the bill, and then we'll get to Representative Niska to your amendment after that. So welcome to the committee, Representative Fisher. We have your bill in front of us as amended. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. And I'm just going to give very quickly on the bill because I know that we're here basically for the subsection 4 enforcement by the AG's office. Basically, what this bill does is allow people to be able to have access to the documents, tools, and parts to be able to repair their equipment when it breaks. As an example, right now, if your car breaks down, you can take it almost anywhere to get it repaired, but you can't do the same with your cell phone. You can't do the same with your printer or your computer. And so one of the things as we were addressing it is we also needed to have a way to enforce it, and that's where we were looking at having a very limited right under 325D44 for individuals, and then at the same time to allow the Attorney General to be able to do it on a larger size. So I will end at that point. I know there could be lots of discussion on the bill itself, but I want to keep it narrowly focused. I will mention that there is no fiscal cost to it. There was a fiscal note closed. It is zero, and I will stop there.
All right. The first testifier I have on the list is Catherine Morkey. Come on up. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Catherine Morkey. I am an Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Wage and Antitrust Division. I am speaking in support of this legislation on behalf of Attorney General Keith Ellison and focusing on enforcement by the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office would enforce this law the same way the Attorney General's office enforces existing antitrust and consumer protection laws. First, we would do outreach about this new law to manufacturers and consumers. We'd help spread the word about obligations and with education work to prevent violations of the law in the first place. Second, when the office, if and when the office receives complaints, we would investigate those complaints. Usually our focus is on patterns and systemic practices, not isolated incidents. And we are discovering the facts and evaluating whether those show a violation of law. If there is noncompliance with the law, step three, we would, we often have the opportunity to correct the action without going to court. And this is especially valuable where you can take quick action. And with some of the constituents who support this bill, farmers, time is money, especially so than for many of us in other situations where getting something repaired without waiting for a court action or driving across the state is critical. As a fourth, as a last resort, and if needed, we would file a lawsuit in court. That under 8.31, we have the option to seek remedies. They include injunctive relief, restitution and disgorgement, civil penalties of up to $25,000 per violation, and the costs and attorney's fees for the lawsuit. If restitution is awarded by the court determines the award. That goes to harmed consumers, the victims. And if civil penalties are awarded by the court, that goes to the general fund, not the AGO. Thank you.
All right. Next on the list, I have Justin Stoffren. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Beckerman and committee members. My name is Justin Stoffren. I'm the Anti-Monopoly Director for the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots organization representing family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities in Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Fisher, as well as I know there are many co-authors on this committee for their leadership on this legislation. And a few members support this bill broadly as a matter of principle. Farmers should have the right to repair the equipment that they own. Specific to this committee's jurisdiction, though, is the enforcement provisions of the bill. MFU has full confidence that the Attorney General's Office will be able to fairly enforce House File 1337, given a track record from the AG's office of using its authority under 8.31 to engage in key litigation helping protect farmers and rural communities. Under its authority under 8.31, the AG's office recently joined 9 other states in the Federal Trade Commission in an antitrust lawsuit against major pesticide manufacturers for using loyalty programs to suppress competition from generic manufacturers. Governor Walz's Executive Order 2010 prohibiting price gouging early on in the pandemic relied on that authority under 8.31. We saw the AG's office use that on multiple occasions to help protect consumers from profiteering. And finally, 8.31 provides the AG's office with the authority to conduct investigations related to a variety of statutes, including antitrust and nonprofit laws. And we've seen the Attorney General's office engage and work to engage in a very thorough investigation of the proposed merger between Sanford Health and Fairview Health Services under that authority. We hope this committee will agree that the Attorney General's office is well positioned to help enforce this legislation and ensure a fair marketplace for repairs in Minnesota. I want to thank you for your time and again to Representative Fisher for his leadership.
All right, thank you. And we do have quite a few members of the public signed up to testify. David Fish and then Lisa Volpe McCabe. Whoever's on deck, if you could maybe grab a chair or get close so we can move things along quickly. We will be limiting testimony to 2 minutes. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Fish. It's not any relationship or has anything to do with Representative Fisher, but we're spelled the same way. In any event, I'm here to represent what's known as MINESTA, which is the Minnesota Electronic Security Technology Association. To make it simple, we are basically the alarm industry in the state of Minnesota. About 20 years ago, the state licensed our industry under 326B.33, and it created two licenses. One a contractor's and one an individual's license. Now, the law specifically states, and I'm just going to read it for you, it makes it illegal for any individual or contractor without a license to install, alter, repair, lay out, supervise any of the activities in within the scope of our industry. In other words, alarm systems, fire alarm, life safety, nurse call systems, video surveillance, access control, everything you see in and around this room. Because of that, it's our contention that House File 1337 is in direct conflict with 326B33 by allowing just anybody to step in and work in our industry without the benefit of the training or the license. We've been told that 1337 doesn't apply to licensed trades in this state. If that's the case, it doesn't say that anywhere in the bill or in any of the amendments. So we're asking that you amend 1337 to include language that excludes a licensed trades in Minnesota or our industry, or perhaps excludes 326B33 through 41 from this bill, this law.
All right. Thank you for your testimony.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Lisa Volpe McCabe and then Tyler Deers on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Beckerfin, members of the committee, my name is Lisa McCabe and I'm with CTIA, the Trade Association for the Wireless Industry. And in looking at Minnesota Attorney General authority related to this bill, I think it's there are a number of important issues to consider. The committee was provided a memorandum prepared by Legislative Council in Vermont that outlines some legal considerations. It was a big document, so it may not be in your packet, but I know it's online. And many states have looked at this issue, over several years. And in addition to safety and security issues, legal issues have been raised. For example, Vermont Legislative Council raised a number of questions from a constitutional perspective. Could this be compared to a law that requires a business to engage with its competitors? Regarding the Dormant Commerce Clause, I'm not a lawyer, but I read the report. Does this bill violate the concept that state regulations may not discriminate against interstate commerce and that states may not impose undue burdens on interstate commerce? Also, could this bill devalue or otherwise hurt existing contracts that manufacturers have with authorized repair providers? Additional legal issues regarding intellectual property and trade secrets and the potential to conflict with federal law also exist. So we feel that this bill raises a number of legal questions. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Tyler Deers is up, and then I have Tara Ryan on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Chairperson Beckerfin and members of the committee. My name is Tyler Deers. I serve as the Midwest Executive Director for TechNet. We're a technology trade association representing over 100 innovative companies, and we are in opposition to House File 1337. I want to just start off by acknowledging Representative Fisher and thank him for his willingness to continue to hear the legitimate concerns that the tech industry has as the bill is currently drafted. We are working on amendment language, and we do feel that we have it in a pretty good spot and are able to share it with the sponsor in moments' time. So we hope we can continue the dialogue with the sponsor well after this committee adjourns today. As it relates to the germaneness of this hearing, we do have concerns with how the remedies provision is drafted under Subdivision 4. Obviously, we are aware of the amendments that were adopted in committee earlier that seek to clarify the enforcement provisions, and we certainly appreciate that clarification. However, it might just be a philosophical concern, but TechNet is opposed to a private right of action of any sort under this proposal and would ask that any bill that may pass the Minnesota House, among other changes as well, include language that would explicitly prohibit or make clear that nothing under the section may be construed or constructed, excuse me, to provide for the basis or to be subject to a private right of action. We think enforcement is best handled with the Attorney General, and certainly appreciate the comments that were made earlier by the AG's office. We have several other substantive concerns with the bill as well. This includes privacy for consumers and the information that is stored on their devices while these devices are being repaired. We want to make sure that that information is being protected, especially when the consumer is dropping off their device at an independent or unvetted third-party repair shop. We also have intellectual property concerns as well, too, with the bill, but I know I outlined those in my previous testimony of jurisdiction, so I won't rehash those, but happy to provide any feedback or answer any questions as it relates to those. So thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Tara Ryan and then John Keene on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tara Ryan. I represent the Entertainment Software Association. ESA represents the three major video game console makers, Microsoft, Nintendo, and Sony, and many of the developers and publishers whose copyrighted works are played on these consoles. I'm here today respectfully to oppose House File 1337. I have submitted written testimony, and I hope that you have a chance to review that, so I'm just going to highlight a few of our concerns with this bill. The bill appears to permit both AG enforcement and a private right of action under the state's deceptive trade practices laws. As we've heard in hearings on this issue around the country, there are individuals who believe that because they own a game console and video game, they should have the right to repair the console. While an individual may own a game console or a video game, they do not own the copyrighted content. For these reasons, we think the bill should be limited to enforcement by the Attorney General's office only. He or whoever is in that seat is in the best position to address any potential violations of this law. That said, we also question whether the Attorney General of Minnesota should be put in a position to enforce this law with regard to game consoles. By granting authority to the Attorney General to enforce this bill as drafted, our members could be subject to unnecessary litigation. House File 1337 fails to recognize copyright protections. Federal copyright law and the DMCA balance the right of the consumer against rights of creators. Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act specifically prohibits trafficking in tools that could circumvent technological protection measures, something that this bill would require. TPMs are the digital locks that video game consoles employ to protect the consoles and to provide a secure media environment for players and other video game publishers and developers. This bill, if passed, would create an untenable position for the video game industry and its copyright owners. A company that exercises its federal right not to distribute the keys to its digital locks would face liability under this Minnesota bill. If the company exercised its federal right, the Attorney General would be in a position to address the violation despite the fact that federal copyright preempts state law. I recognize I'm out of time. The FTC and the Copyright Office have found that video game consoles create a unique situation where piracy is the biggest threat to the industry, and any access to TPMs that allow people to get into that is a big concern for our industry. I'm happy to answer any questions. I encourage you to vote against House File 1337.
All right, John Keene, thank you for your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Chair, members of the committee. My name is John King of the Association of Home Appliance Manufacturers, also known as AHAM, and we're in opposition to House File 1337. Our industry covers everything from your refrigerator, clothes washer, or microwave, without the handling of high-cost electricity and refrigerant gases. In regards to enforcement, it's important to remember for appliances, those repairs often occur in people's homes, which raises additional safety and security considerations, meeting certain standards, building codes, energy codes, and whatnot. It also opens a threat to specific property damage, including instances we have heard of using the wrong refrigerant, using counterfeit parts leading to electric shock. I do want to mention that appliance manufacturers are already providing a wide range of repair options, including a nationwide home appliance service repair network, many of them here in Minnesota. The question for enforcement is how this bill enforces against bad actors, people coming into your house and doing improper things. Our repair network provides traceability of repairs. How do you enforce untraceable repair people? To conclude, appliances are complex products that require training and accountability. Untrained repairs can compromise safety and security, and that's why we opposed to this bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, we will move on to the Representative Niska. I believe it's, you're the only one over there. So, Representative Niska, would you like to move your amendment and then tell us about it?
I would. So my amendment is the A3 amendment, and first I think I need to orally amend it to strike line 1.4, which has already been amended.
Okay.
In the bill.
Is that correct,
Chair,
Council?
Chair and members, because they're identical, it's okay, and you don't have to.
Okay, there you go.
So yes, my amendment is the A3 amendment, and I would move adoption of the A3 amendment. And the purpose of the A3 amendment, and again, this came out of discussions that Representative Fisher and I had in the Commerce Commerce Committee, where this bill previously was. And really, this is to get Subdivision 4 of the bill to align with both the title of Subdivision 4 and I think the more rational way for this bill to operate. So Subdivision 4 is entitled Enforcement by Attorney General. And I appreciate the explanation that we got from the Attorney General's office about the process that they would use to enforce this law, that they would go through outreach and then investigation, then potentially court action. If that court action was necessary and successful, that they would provide restitution to the individuals who had actually suffered damages from it. And that would, and all of that would be handled in one enforcement action by the Attorney General. I think that is a much better way to handle this type of a law, enforcement of this type of a law, than the Uniform Deceptive Trade Practices Act, which is section 325D.44. The Uniform Deceptive Trade Practices Act is not enforced by the Attorney General. It's only enforced by private individuals. And the reason for that is if you look at the examples in 325D.44, all the other things that are called out as deceptive trade practices in that section are about individual transactions or limited groups of transactions that are best handled in individual actions brought by the plaintiffs who were harmed in those particular things, like mislabeling of goods or passing off goods as the goods of someone else. This law, in order for it to work the way it's supposed to work, is really much more about the statewide terms that an original equipment manufacturer would offer documentation or tools on. So if you look at Subdivision 3, starting in line 4.20, the actual guts of this bill are about whether the terms that an OEM offers their parts or documentation on are fair and reasonable. So Apple or John Deere or some other OEM is going to, under this bill, is going to offer their parts and tools on certain terms. And either those terms are fair and reasonable under Minnesota law or they're not. In order for, I think, this bill to operate well, if it's going to operate, and I do have some concerns about that we can address later, but in order for it to operate well, I think it's really, really going to be best to be driven entirely through the Attorney General's office, where the Attorney General's office has a dialogue with Apple or John Deere about whether their terms are fair and reasonable. They can choose whether or not to go forward with an investigation. If they choose to, then in Ramsey County District Court or wherever that lawsuit is brought, that's the right place, I think, that case is decided on initial matter on whether the terms are fair and reasonable. If the Attorney General does not go forward, and I appreciate, TechNet saying that they would like to have no private right of action. In an ideal world, maybe I would agree with them. I'm trying to be constructive within the context of your bill. I think that 8.31 subdivision 3A would provide for a cause of action under my amendment. Farmer suing John Deere or a parts, an unauthorized repairer suing Apple would be able to bring that action. They would be able to bring that action stepping into the shoes of the Attorney General, and they would have to show that action would be brought for a public benefit. So I understand that that's maybe a sticking point in terms of thinking about this in terms of 8.31. I do think that in a case in which someone stepping into the shoes of the Attorney General could show to the satisfaction of a district court judge that the terms that an OEM is offering are not fair and reasonable, I think the public benefit standard would almost certainly be met in that circumstance. So I think that's the right way to do it. And the reason why I think the Uniform Deceptive Trade Practices Act really is the wrong way to do it is because in that scenario in which the Attorney General doesn't bring an action, but you have, you know, 100 farmers across the state of Minnesota who think that, and I shouldn't pick on John Deere because John Deere actually just announced a memorandum of understanding with the Farmers Bureau, I understand, but so maybe it's unfair to pick on them, but just using John Deere as an example, if 100 farmers across the state of Minnesota thought that the terms that John Deere is offering are not fair and reasonable, and they brought 100 different lawsuits and different district court judges, I don't want a district court in Candy, Ohio County, and a district court in Stearns County, and a district court in St. Louis County, and a district court in Anoka County to have, you know, come up with 4 different answers, or 3 different answers, or even 2 different answers. I think that's an unfair position to put everybody in, frankly, and I think that that's not really the way that the bill is designed to work. So that's the purpose of the A3 amendment, and it really is offered with an effort to be constructive about a piece of legislation that I don't think on balance is the right approach, but I do think that if we're going to go forward with this piece of legislation, I think this is a really important way to clean it up and prevent some, I think, bad unintended consequences.
Thank you for being so succinct.
I didn't promise to be brief.
For an amendment that's like 10 words. Representative Fisher, to the amendment.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and Representative Niska. I appreciate the exchanges that we've had and the discussions on it. And as I've looked at the private right of action, I feel that what is under the AGs is too limiting for it. And what I'm thinking of, and going back to the farm situation, is that, and I'll use manufacturer B so that we don't malign anyone, is that you could have a situation where the farmer needs to get a manual to be able to get a repart done very quickly so they can get going back in the field, and they might be denied. And they need something that's a little bit quicker than going through the AG's office, and I think this is one of the ways that they're able to have some exercise to be able to keep that moving along. And that's one of the reasons I like make sure we leave it in. I do know that the AG's office is also here, and they could also provide some clarity as to what the differences are between 325 and their current, the way we've got it written for them also. So if you like, we could also have them talk to that.
We'd also like to get to our other bill today. So we've got 3 lines of a bill are before us. Representative Fisher, so do you support or not support?
I'm sorry. It'd be a no. I apologize. I should.
All right. Any further discussion to the A3 amendment? Representative Niska.
I this time I will.
Sure.
I just would say that under 8.31 there is injunctive relief that could be brought by a plaintiff. I think that would solve the problem in the particular situation that you're talking about. That they still would be able to bring an 8.31 subdivision 3A action, getting to try to get that injunctive relief. And so I do think, again, I really genuinely am trying to persuade the majority that this is a good amendment. I think that if you're going to pass this bill, this is an important fix to it. So, thank you.
All right. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. This is a valiant effort. Well done. Now to the underlying bill, member discussion, any discussion to the bill? Maybe you've said all the important things that need to be said. Representative Niska.
No, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I do still have a couple of other questions. I wanted to start with the fiscal note, Representative Fisher, that assumed zero costs for the Attorney General's office and enforcement and zero costs, or specifically didn't account for legal challenges of the legislation. And I was interested to hear a comment on a couple of the items that were brought up, and starting with the dormant commerce clause, whether this discriminates or creates an undue burden on interstate commerce. Do you know whether similar laws have passed and and been challenged and the outcomes of any of those challenges?
Representative Fisher, I'll let you answer that, but the only reason this bill is in this committee is lines 5.1 through 5.3 regarding enforceability. So we're going to stick real tight to that. I'll allow this one, but we're not going to go into any other questions that are outside of the question before us is should the AG provision be in the bill or not. But Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Niska. I know that there's a memorandum of understanding on the car in the car industry. I haven't heard of any challenges on that. And I think there's a something similar, was it Massachusetts? Did some kind of law, but it's very new, and I haven't heard. There's nothing that's been happening. Yeah, the auto law. Okay.
All right. Anything else, Representative Niska, specifically to the reason that it's in this committee?
Madam Chair, my other questions were about things like the conflict with copyright law, I suppose.
I suppose that hopefully was discussed in Commerce Committee. So understand that you really want to talk about this bill, but we do have to stick to the schedule, and we do have people in multiple places. That's obviously why you're by yourself over there. So want to keep us as tight as we can. Any other discussion to the bill as amended?
Madam Chair,
Representative Niska.
I think you're out of order speaking to the motives.
It's not speaking to the motives, speaking to the physical reasons they can't be in two places at one time. We do not have time turners. Representative Niska, final comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have some really serious concerns about whether there are legal challenges that that will be successfully brought against this bill, in particular on the conflict with federal copyright law as well. I do appreciate that we did clarify the Attorney General enforcement provision a little bit more cleanly, and I do hope that perhaps in some further discussions down the line, I can prevail upon the bill author to fix the problem that I think is a serious problem in the way that the enforcement provision is written. So thank you.
And you can have all the time that Representative Fisher will give you, but not in my committee. with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1337 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Representative Moeller, would you like to move House File 1791 be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my motion.
All right, and I see you've got a couple testifiers. Do you want to go straight to the testifiers, or do you have a couple opening comments?
I have a little bit of an opening.
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. So I started learning about the problem for consumers with long-term care and long-term disability insurance when I was first elected. Some of my constituents reached out about not getting the benefits they paid for with long-term care insurance. And then I connected with Attorney Elizabeth Roble, who I actually used to work with years ago. And I learned that this was a big problem for Minnesotans who lacked a remedy for claims that were denied in bad faith. And my testifiers will provide more information about how this bill works. But please look at the packet of letters that you have describing how hardworking Minnesotans paid for long-term care or long-term disability plans. And then these Minnesotans expected the insurance companies to hold up their end of the bargain if a valid claim was made. What you'll see in both the packet of letters, so there's a stapled packet of letters, and then there's a Department of Commerce complaint logs in summary, is that vulnerable people, often elderly people with dementia or Alzheimer's, are denied by their long-term care plans when a valid claim is made and care is needed. For those who have family members to help them, those family members are spending countless hours getting the runaround from these insurance companies. The victims are expending exorbitant out-of-pocket costs for coverage that they paid these insurance companies for but were ignored or denied. With that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
All right. Elizabeth Roble.
And Madam Chair, if my testifiers that are going to, you're going to just come down and.
Yep. And you can pull up some other chairs. There's plenty of chairs to go around today. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening. My name is Elizabeth Roble. I practice law in St. Paul, and I handle long-term care insurance disputes on the side of policyholders. I was retained in my first long-term care dispute in 2012. I'd only been in private practice a few years, and I had been working in the public sector for well over a decade. Among other things, I prosecuted crimes against vulnerable adults and white-collar fraud schemes against Medicare and Medicaid. My first client, Helen, had severe dementia. Due to family history, Helen's husband insisted that she purchase a long-term care insurance policy in 91. He knew he would probably predecease her, which he did, and he knew she'd probably develop dementia, which she did. Helen paid premiums for over 20 years. By the time she moved into an assisted living facility, she couldn't live on her own safely. Helen's daughter, Marilyn, attempted to assist her with the claims process. By the time I was hired, Helen had been battling the insurance company for months, and despite countless phone calls where Marilyn was provided inconsistent and erroneous answers to coverage questions, and Marilyn providing the company with every single document they requested, denials continued. It was a moving target. Each denial had a different basis. When I took on the internal appeal, I attacked it like a trial lawyer, and I offered all evidence I could to demonstrate how Helen's needs satisfied the policy terms. I even included a videotape of Helen showing her unquestionable memory loss and her inability to keep herself safe. With my near Herculean effort, the company finally paid. When Marilyn learned the news, she called me crying. After months and months of fighting and the uncertainty of Helen's claims not getting paid, Marilyn finally felt vindicated. She was able to honor her father's wishes to ensure that Helen was taken care of and that the care was paid for. Since Helen, I have represented dozens of policyholders in these types of disputes. The facts may vary, the companies may differ, but the egregious claims handling is the same. Ignoring plain policy language, ignoring clear medical evidence, requiring repeated nursing assessments that eventually find the elderly policyholder suddenly ineligible after receiving benefits, differing basis for denial, and the most agonizing delay. Last spring, I made a data practices request to the Department of Commerce. I wanted to see if they were seeing the similar complaints. I received well over 100 redacted complaints that spanned over 3.5 years, and our office created an index so I could look at the substance of the complaints. And what we found was all consistent with what my clients had endured. Policyholders should not be required to pay lawyers to access the benefits they've paid for. Few policyholders have the financial, emotional, and physical wherewithal to take on the complex medical and legal issues that arise and are often fabricated by insurance companies. These long-term care insurance practices are unacceptable, and they can't go unchecked without an appropriate legal remedy. What we're seeking and what we hope you support is an amendment to the Minnesota bad faith law to clarify and ensure that long-term care insurance is not excluded from this law.
Thank you for your testimony. Mark Veda? I don't care, whatever order you guys want to go in, that's just the order you were on the list. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great, thank you. Good evening. My name is Mark Vita. My father, John Vita, was a Minnesota public school teacher for 30 years. And in 1992, at the age of 64, he purchased long-term care insurance. In August 2019, at the age of 90, my father was living in Eveleth, Minnesota. After a series of falls in his apartment, I was contacted by Ascensia Hospital in Virginia, where he was recovering. As my father's only surviving immediate family member, I was informed that my father's dementia had progressed to a diagnosis of severe, and St. Louis County would no longer allow him to be discharged home. The county and the hospital were insisting that he go into a transitional care facility for recovery and further evaluation, with eventual admission into assisted living or memory care. We immediately moved my father into St. Therese of New Hope. My father's on-site assessment at St. Therese confirmed the findings from Ascensia Hospital. My father was chronically ill with dementia and had severe cognitive impairment. After a few months, I contacted his long-term care insurance company, Transamerica. I proceeded to submit the required forms and written documents, all confirming my father's condition as well as the necessary facility licenses. Before Transamerica would move forward with any determination of qualification of benefits, they required my father submit to an in-person assessment by their chosen provider. By now, it was March 2020, and the COVID-19 pandemic had required my father's facility to be under a lockdown. Therefore, this assessment was to be done over the phone. After a 15-minute phone call with my father and the Transamerica nurse, of which my father answered 4 out of 18 questions correctly, it was determined by Transamerica that my father was no longer severely cognitively impaired, and therefore he didn't have a chronic illness as defined in his policy, and therefore he didn't qualify for long-term care benefits. I thought, how could a 15-minute phone call contradict multiple in-person medical analyses spanning many months? Dementia was a progressive disease, and my father's health was declining. My father had paid his long-term care insurance premiums for 26 years, but in his hour of need, his insurance company refused to recognize his medical condition and therefore denied all coverage. My father's financial costs continued to mount. After months of gathering further medical documentation, initiating countless phone calls and emails regarding my father's condition, and after having multiple rejections from Transamerica, I sought legal assistance. I retained Elizabeth Warble as my attorney. Finally, in December 2020, 9 months after the original 15-minute phone call analysis, Transamerica agreed to conduct an additional medical analysis of my father, who thankfully was still alive. This medical analysis confirmed the original findings from August 2019. My father was chronically ill with dementia and required substantial supervision for his own safety due to his severe cognitive impairment. In conclusion, it took months and months of effort involving administrative tasks, legal navigation, medical coordinating, and hiring a private attorney to get my father's long-term care insurance company to fulfill their contractual obligations. Sadly, the time-intensive effort required during this 18-month ordeal not only disrupted my personal career, but also took away meaningful time I could have spent with my father. My father passed away in September 2021. Any corrective legislation to alleviate this experience from other Minnesota residents would be a huge quality of life benefit. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Kate McKinnon, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good evening. My name is Kate McKinnon. I am an attorney in St. Paul. I focus my practice on disability insurance disputes. Disability insurance is where a person gets an income replacement when he or she is unable to work due to a medical condition. The kinds of disability insurance vary, and the kinds we're talking about here are individually purchased disability policies that are subject to state law, and disability policies provided by employers who happen to be the government or a religious institution. And the reason for that is those are exempt from the federal ERISA law. Otherwise, they would be covered by ERISA. But we need the state of Minnesota to cover those who have individual disabilities or who are state employees or church employees. What happens with a disability benefit is that the individual receives a portion, not complete, but a portion, typically 50 to 60% of their pre-disability earnings while they're disabled. Good insurers pay these benefits, and they pay them timely. However, in my practice, every single day, I see multiple insurers routinely saying no to claimants that have legitimate disability benefit claims. And these are complicated cases, typically involving substantial amounts of medical records and legal issues. So, what can an insured do? Well, we thought in 2008, when Minnesota Statute 604.18 was passed, that there was some little bit of energy to try and equal the playing field a little bit, and that there would be a potential bad faith claim if an insurer denied benefits unreasonably. Unfortunately, in 2021, a federal district court here in Minnesota, in a case called Zimmerman versus Standard Insurance, declared that our statute, our bad faith statute, does not apply to disability insurers because disability insurers, contrary to what most rational people would think, we are health insurers. Disability insurers are health insurers, or that's what the law allegedly said. We're here today to correct this rather tangled piece of
statute with a simple fix. It hardly requires any changes to the language, and make sure that the statute covers disability insurance and, among other things, disability insurance and long-term care. And just by completing my statement, I want to just give you my example of one of my clients. And of course, my clients are unable to come here because most of them are disabled. And frankly, a lot of them are on claim or still in dispute with their insurers and don't want to be public. Mr. G, my client, is a county employee in Minneapolis. He has multiple medical conditions involving breathing, walking, eating, and a whole bunch of other functions. He was found totally disabled by the PERA organization, as well as the Social Security Disability Insurance. And by the way, that doesn't mean he got to triple up. Those were benefits that reduced his disability benefits, his employer-supplied disability benefits. Nevertheless, after he had received PERA and SSDI, this carrier said, whoops, nope, you're not disabled anymore. Go forth. This client should have a remedy, and it's going to be hard for him to do anything because, in fact, partial benefits offset by these other things mean he's only going to be out $900 a month. Meanwhile, all that he can collect in suit over this are $900 a month times the number of months that have elapsed since he was cut off. You can't get a lawyer to represent you for that kind of stuff. And yet, that means he can't pay his rent. And we're here today to just make a small change in the statute so that bad faith will fall into the bad faith statute and be covered. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. The last person I have signed up is Robin Rowan. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MFSI. MFSI members promote the financial security of Minnesotans through the sale of products such as life insurance and annuities, paid family and medical leave products, and long-term care insurance. MFSI members paid out in 2022 over $41 million a day in benefits to Minnesotans. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today and to express our concerns about House File 1791. I also want to thank Representative Mueller for being very open to discussing our concerns and digging into the issue, even to the extent of watching Senate Commerce hearings from 2008, which not many people will do. House File 1791 significantly expands Minnesota's bad faith in, insurance law to include not only long-term care and disability, but it also includes other health insurance related products, including vision, Medicare supplement, blanket accident, income replacement, and dental insurance written by any other company than Delta Dental. This expansion will expose these products to an additional $350,000 in costs beyond the policy limits, increased litigation, nuisance lawsuits, all of which will increase the premiums for these really important products. When the bad faith law was enacted in 2008, and at the risk of giving clues to my age, I will tell you that I was there, and it was very intentionally limited to homeowners and auto insurance only, products that consumers are required to purchase. By contrast, the health insurance health-related products that are targeted by 1791 are voluntary products that the state encourages individuals to purchase. So, for example, Department of Human Services has a Own Your Future division, which is one of their primary focuses is to make long-term care insurance more affordable and available for Minnesotans so that they can take care of their own long-term care needs and stay off of medical assistance. Increasing the cost of this important coverage through unnecessary litigation.
If you can finish your sentence.
we'll make it, put it out of the reach of middle-income Minnesotans. I would also just like to say a few additional words that there are significant remedies for people who are experiencing unlawful denials and delays by insurance companies. The Department of Commerce has the Unfair Claims Practices Act, which is one of the strictest laws in the country. It prohibits unreasonably denying or delaying claim payments. Minnesota's law is stricter than other states
because it allows, it, other states will require the department to prove that there's a general pattern in practice. In other words, more individuals have been impacted than just one. But Minnesota, Minnesota law allows the insurance department to take action if an insurance company wrongfully denies or delays one company, and then just one claim. And then very briefly, the log that was referred to by one of Representative Mueller's testifiers is not a Department of Commerce log. It's a log that she created, as she correctly stated. But I think it demonstrates that Commerce is actually doing a great job. One of the companies that was mentioned here today, over half, just under half of the complaints in that log were related to one company's behavior. And Commerce Department took action, fined them over $500,000, and then provided remedies in a corrective action plan.
And so, I'll remind you, this is going to the Commerce Committee, so you'll have more opportunity to testify about the commerce side of things.
I know,
when you get there.
I get very passionate about the commerce side of things. So
yeah, but this isn't the Commerce Committee, and in full disclosure, I am solo parenting, and we need to wrap up today. So we can't just go on forever about things that aren't within the jurisdiction of this mm-hmm. committee. So the reality of where we are, I appreciate your testimony, but we'll ask you to wrap up.
I understand, Madam Chair. Thank you. I have a child that I have to get to the airport as well. Insurance companies have to keep their promises. Otherwise, people don't buy their products. These are voluntary products. And we just don't think encouraging more litigation is an efficient or effective way to protect consumers in this situation. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Passing the gavel.
Yep. All right, thank you to the testifiers. We'll now open it up for member discussion.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for the experts who initially spoke, perhaps the attorney. I'm a horrible person, I forgot the name. Anyway, the attorney who represents folks in long-term care or the disability, actually either. Yeah, so I just heard some conflicting things. I'm sorry. And I just wanted to make sure I had clarity. So I had a couple of questions for the experts. So when you were initially testifying and when Representative Mueller was explaining this bill, it sounded like this was a fairly simple line edit that was going to expand the bad faith claims statute to incorporate long-term care and disability. But then our last testifier said that it would actually expand it to include everything under the sun. And so I just wanted to understand where in the spectrum between just these two things and everything this change would actually encompass.
Ms. Rubble.
Sure. The current exception or exclusion is health carrier. And we look at that definition, and we're looking to change it to health plan. Within health plan, there's a bunch of exclusions. One is disability insurance. Another is long-term care insurance. Then there is also blanket accident and a few other line items. That's true. So I think we're talking about a couple different things. First of all, they're kind of trying to weave in this whole floodgate argument. And in all honesty, we have a number of lawyers here, and we've all kind of decided who was going to take what role. And I'm going to ask Kate McKinnon to address that, because we knew that that would be one of the concerns.
Ms. McKinnon.
So I can tell you there will be no floodgate in Minnesota. So what we're doing here, when the bill, the statute in 604.18 was originally passed, the exemptions to the act were very specific, and they were set out in the statute. And they included in subdivision, I think it's subdivision 2 of the original bill, subdivision A3 of the bill, a contract issued by a nonprofit health service plan corporation, a written agreement of a health carrier is defined in section 62A011. Well, that sounds like really lawyery, but what it did it was supposed to be health insurers. And instead, we had this language in A2, a written agreement of a health carrier is defined in section 62A011. So then you go to 62A011, and lo and behold, it's a very lengthy definition of health carriers. And then there's an exception to the definition of health carrier, and there's in fact 14 exceptions in that definitional section, including part one, which is long-term disability insurance, and part nine, which is long-term care insurance. So what we had was an exception to an exception. And anybody who studied grammar, that's a double negative. It's a positive. But unfortunately, a judge here in Minnesota said differently. The judge saw this as being a way in which disability insurers, long-term care insurers, are health insurers. The problem here, what we're trying to do, is to get it so that those exceptions to the exception in 62A.011 subdivision 3 are where they always were, which is to say subject to the bad faith statute. We're not expanding the law. We're just putting it where it always was, but got a little muddled. And so sometimes you have to come here to fix these things.
Thank you. Representative Feist, any follow-up?
Yes. I just wanted to move on quickly to my second question. I just wanted to make sure I understood. So if we aren't incorporating disability and long-term care into the bad faith claim statute, what would be the remedies? Because it seems like if a company commits fraud, that there should be a cause of action. So I just want to make sure I understand, like, if we aren't able to do this, then what remedies are there under the existing law?
The only remedy is a breach of contract under state law.
Go ahead, Ms. McKinney.
Pardon me. The only remedy is breach of contract under state law. And under Minnesota law, absent the bad faith remedy, there is no right to attorney's fees for a first-party insurance dispute. Okay, so that means when your insurance company wrongfully says, no, we're not going to pay you, or we're only going to pay you a small portion, you have to hire a lawyer to get to you to the place that you should have gotten at without a lawyer. So you're really out the money. So, no, there are no other remedies under Minnesota law. And if I might just go one step further, the suggestion was made that the Unfair Claims Practices Act fills this void. It doesn't. The Minnesota Supreme Court has held that the Unfair Claims Practices Act gives the Department of Commerce a right to sue sort of on behalf of the public, but it doesn't give an individual a private right of action. So there are no other rights.
Thank you, Ms. McKinney. Representative Feist?
Thank you so much. That was helpful.
Representative Niska?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the first question I had, Representative Moeller, or maybe this is a question for Ms. Robel. This document was given to us in our packets. It's like a 13-page summary document. I think Ms. Robel referenced making some sort of summary, and I was wondering, is that this document?
Representative Moeller.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. That's a summary that she made based on her data practices request of Department of Commerce.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moeller. Just so, and you can correct me if I'm misunderstanding this, this document isn't created itself by the Department of Commerce. It's something that Ms. Robel, private practice attorney, created based on information she had gotten about different complaints from the Department of Commerce. I think that I'm understanding that correctly. I just want to make sure that we're 100% crystal clear about that.
Representative Moeller.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Niska, that's correct. She created this document. However, just to put a little context to it, we first brought this bill last year. We knew that the industry didn't like it, and so we tried to chat with them, work things out. That's why I looked at the 2008 legislative hearings and listened, tried to understand where this came from. And we were told at the time, basically, show us the proof that this is happening. Show us some evidence that this is happening beyond what these attorneys who do this work were experiencing. And so then Ms. Robel did make that data practices request, and then it's just a way to try to summarize everything, created this document based on that request.
Any follow-up, Representative Niska?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moeller. And I don't mean to suggest that there's anything untoward about it. I just want to make sure that we're clear about
what somebody's the, phone. Sorry, someone's phone. Someone's was talking. Phone,
yeah. What the document is, but I did want to move on to address the point Representative Feist had raised, and I think the difference of opinion between Ms. McKinnon and Ms. Rowan isn't about whether this opens the floodgates; it's whether the floodgates already should have been opened before, and we're just bringing all of these at least 14 line items, which Representative Feist, anyone is welcome to read subdivision 3 of 62A.011. There are it's a very lengthy list of exclusions, which I think now are all brought into bad faith litigation. Many more items besides just disability and long-term care. Perhaps this would be a different discussion if the bill were only limited to bringing disability and long-term care into this. But Representative Moeller, I guess my main concern with the bill is it's really, I mean, I definitely have there's no question in my mind that some insurance claims handlers do a bad job of handling claims. Sometimes they're dishonest. Sometimes even companies as a whole have a bad culture and do things badly. It looks like Transamerica certainly was doing that. And so the question really to me is about the best method of enforcing it. And Minnesota does have a little bit different than some other states, which do have more of a Wild West approach to bad faith litigation. We have a very robust Department of Commerce and a very robust Unfair Claims Practices Act that we do that. And then there is an existing individual coverage lawsuit for breach of contract claim. And so I think really the question is whether that's a good way to handle these or whether we need to add the costs of bad faith litigation on top of that framework. The Transamerica example, which is I do understand about half of the complaints in the summary that Ms. Robel or Robel provided for us, it seems to me was handled pretty well by the Commerce Department. So that's not a terribly persuasive reason why we need to change our approach and increase the cost on top of that. So I'm curious whether because we do have, different states taking different approaches, whether we have some way of knowing how individual premiums and vision and dental and things like that are going to go up if we create a potential additional litigation risk on top of those companies, if you know.
Chair Moeller, if you could decipher the question, please.
Well, and I'll just start by, because you did reference the, I'm assuming you're referencing the consent order that involved Transamerica as being, and I know the testifier talked about that, like this is a remedy. They were ordered to pay $500,000. It's my understanding that this consent order is very rare and that this number is something like, and I can ask my testifier to come up and explain that. But what you're hearing from the testifiers today and this complaint log, it is well beyond a problem with Transamerica. That people, if you look through the examples given in this complaint log, people are told to fax information, email, phone calls, constantly to try to get the benefits that they deserve. And they shouldn't have to go hire an attorney, I think, as you said, just to get the benefits that are coming to them. And then who are they gonna hire? There are very few attorneys who do this and they're not getting attorney's fees. And so that's where the problem lies.
Ms. Provo.
I'd also like to address this. So with the commerce action, they did issue a consent order in 2022 for $500,000. What we didn't include is there was also a consent order against Transamerica in 2019. So we're talking about Transamerica having one consent order and then continuing to engage in all the same behavior and then having another consent order in 2020. And then 2019 consent order talks about the fact that the Commerce Department had been investigating Transamerica since 2015. What you need to understand, especially with people who are who have long-term care insurance or disability, they don't have 10 or 15 years to get a remedy, right? My clients are typically on claim for 2 years
and then they die. I mean, most of my policyholders, similar to Mr. Vida, are in their 90s. One of the women who actually wrote the letter in my packet, she's 98 years old, and her husband's 99. And they're just now getting their claims. So there's so the Department of Commerce serves a very important function. And that's not to say that it isn't, we don't have robust laws around enforcement. I used to work at the AG's office, and we did a lot of enforcement actions. Serves a great function. But there we have something missing. Also included in the packet is a survey of 50 states that talks about bad faith laws in other states. All those other states include exactly what we're talking about. All those other states have enforcement agencies who are just as robust as ours. I don't know that our Department of Commerce is unique, and I will acknowledge that they do a good job. There are a lot of insurance commissioners' offices that do good jobs across the United States, and they still have bad faith laws that are clear about including long-term care insurance and disability.
Thank you, Ms. Rover. Representative Nisko, one more follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mueller and Ms. Robel, I appreciate the concern for that we need to move things quickly. I've done a lot of civil litigation. Getting from complaint to judgment in under 2 years would be quite a feat in a civil litigation case, too. So I don't think that saying we're going to channel more of it to civil litigation with attorney's fees is really a resolution to the problem. I think that, frankly, the Commerce Department probably can get people things faster. That's been my experience, that administrative agencies are able to get things faster. But my question really is, and the question I was trying to get at earlier, and I apologize, Mr. Chair, if that wasn't clear, was about the cost that this is going to create. Because, you know, insurance companies don't just have free money sitting around. They have, you know, when costs are imposed on insurance companies, that money has to come from somewhere, and it generally has to come from premiums. And so if we're talking about creating new sources of liability on insurers, including the ones who aren't Transamerica, who aren't bad actors, there are going to be costs. They're going to have to reserve additional costs for litigation and additional potential liability. So how's that going to increase premiums? Is there any way of knowing how that's going to increase premiums?
Representative Mueller, if you can.
And I'll just turn this over to my testifier, if you can answer that question.
Ms. Froebel?
Well, part of this is a floodgate. Like, I think everybody's always concerned, like, oh my goodness, the lawyers are going to come storming the courtrooms and suing everybody. And we actually looked up how many lawsuits have been filed and amended. And so with our bad faith law, you have to understand there's like essentially three gatekeepers before you even get the remedies, right? So the first gatekeeper is you file a complaint and you can't even allege bad faith until the judge says it's bad faith. So there has to be a factual determination by the court to even have that as part of your complaint. The second gatekeeper is to find that bad faith even happened, and that would be the judge or jury. And then the third gatekeeper is the judge who would actually award the damages. So a lot of the research I did, I found a lot of courts actually not allowing the complaint to be amended at all. And then when we looked at other, I think there were literally just a handful of cases that had these allegations. So this sense that there's just going to be this floodgate and have all these additional costs that are going to eventually be passed on to the policyholders is a myth. I mean, there really isn't. And I think the other thing is, you know, so much of the policyholders, at least I have for long-term care insurance, their premiums have been paid. Right, they've been paying their premiums for 20, 30 years. So that ship has sailed. I can't speak for what the insurance industry is going to do. They seem to raise my premiums all the time, right? So I can't speak to that. But to be concerned that premiums are going to be raised and to deny people benefits, you know, so an auto insurance accident gets bad faith, but my client, you know, John Vida doesn't. Some of our most vulnerable Minnesotans do not have the protections that you and I do through auto insurance and housing insurance. I mean, it just doesn't make sense, and I frankly don't think it's consistent with what the bad faith law set out to do.
Thank you, Ms. Rover. Representative Mueller, any closing statements?
I just really appreciate the opportunity for the hearing, and again, want to just take it back to the letters and the packet, the description of how real Minnesotans are getting harmed by bad practices, and they just want their day in court. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Rep. Mueller renews the motion to re-refer House File 1791 to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Motion passes. This meeting is now adjourned.